Endgame.
It's finished. We're finished. Nearly finished.
Nearly finished? Even playwright Samuel Beckett could not have written the script for the 2008 campaign. Interminable plot twists, inscrutable lines, and it appears we've only finished Act One. Waiting for the Democrats. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 2nd, and we start this hurricane season with a story worthy of Kafka. FEMA trailers, once a symbol of government help in the aftermath of Katrina, now a symbol of homelessness as people face a deadline to get out today. Worries for students looking for loans and a credit crunch. There is good news for the NBA, the final set up to be an epic bi-coastal battle, Boston versus Los Angeles. And we have movie reviews from you. That and all the news. Senator Ted Kennedy is having surgery to remove his cancerous brain tumor just about an hour from now. The 76-year-old was diagnosed nearly 2 weeks ago with an especially difficult-to-treat type of brain tumor. The surgery will take place at Duke University Medical Center. Chemotherapy and radiation will follow. Her win in Puerto Rico's primary yesterday is another victory for Hillary Clinton, but it's not likely to change the outcome in the Democratic race for delegates. Clinton gained 38 delegates, but Obama's 17 puts him just 47 delegates short of what's needed to clinch the nomination. On the Sunday talk shows, Democratic Party Chairman Howard Dean and others are still talking about a battle continuing.
We don't want to go to the convention, have a big fight at the convention, and lose the presidency.
So I was hoping for a big fight, you know, they're throwing their special K boxes at the hotel or whatever.
Are we sure it's over? It ain't over.
You want to jump in there?
No, I don't want to jump in there.
Roughly 200 superdelegates remain uncommitted, but party leaders are urging them to decide soon. The final Democratic primaries take place tomorrow in Montana and South Dakota.
Car bomb has killed at least 8 people near the Danish embassy in Pakistan's capital. At least a dozen others are wounded, and the blast has caused a lot of damage in the areas. The BBC claims 8 people have died. The chief of the International Atomic Energy Agency says Syria has agreed to let inspectors in later this month to investigate allegations of illegal nuclear activity.
And oil prices are holding steady around $127 a barrel in overnight trading as investors determine if the market's year-long bull run is over. The Dow Jones stands at 12,638 after closing slightly down on Friday. The S&P 500 is at 1,400 and the NASDAQ is at 2522.
There's also a big fire at the Universal lot over the weekend. It destroyed a bunch of archived television programs. I'd love the takeaway question to be something like, what TV program would you love to see destroyed in a fire at Universal? But Adora won't let me do anything
that negative. I might surprise you, though.
You go for that?
I might.
All right. Well, we also have some of your movie reviews. Here's one.
Sex and the City has a pre-release adulation that's comparable to, say, The Passion of the Christ.
More from that reviewer later, and we'd like to know if you've paid off your student loans. We're going to talk about the credit crisis and student loans as people consider financial
aid. And tell
aid.
Us your story about anything in this program, and you can do that by giving us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Destroyed TV archives on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Senator Clinton is an outstanding public servant, and she is going to be a great asset when we go into November to make sure that we defeat the Republicans. That I can promise you.
I also want to recognize Senator Obama and his supporters. Our two campaigns have turned out record numbers of new voters, determined to chart a new course for America.
That's the two Democratic rivals speaking warmly about one another this weekend. And it's hard to believe, John, that this has been a hard-fought Democratic primary that has been going on for 5 months, and it's finally coming to a close with just two more primaries tomorrow in South Dakota and Montana.
And look, they're friends, Obama and Clinton. They're, like, totally friends now.
There's certainly a different note there, isn't there? Well, wouldn't you say, Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaway's political director?
Well, yesterday there was some real hardening of feelings. The vote on Saturday by the Rules and Bylaws Committee to allocate Michigan's delegates by a formula that didn't reflect either campaign's wishes or desires seems to have caused a lot of upset in the Democratic Party. And I've heard many, many Democrats say about Hillary Clinton, how could she ask to change the rules that way? It's so unfair. And I've had people ask about Barack Obama, how could he get votes that weren't his to get? So there was some trauma. As a matter of fact, you could hear it right after the vote on Saturday night. I think we have a little clip of that. Of people shouting.
Denver!
And what they're yelling is Denver, 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 unhappy with the way it was going for Hillary Clinton. She was giving interviews late last night after her victory in Puerto Rico, where she was suggesting that it may not end immediately, that they're reserving their right to go to Denver, although even some big supporters of her, including, for example, Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, is recommending against that option. But there are those in the Clinton camps that feel stunned, as they say, that even though she's won so many primaries by such wide margins in the last 2 months, she is going to be stepping out of this primary unless lightning strikes like it has been doing in South Dakota all night, as a matter of fact.
Well, Andrea, you are in South Dakota. I mean, just very, very quickly, if the Clinton campaign was to take this to the convention, there's no chance that mathematically it would affect the outcome, even if they did seat all the delegates, is it?
Probably not. And there does seem to be a coalition of Clinton supporters urging her to wake up and smell the coffee and face that reality. But when you think how long this has been going on, and as it gets very close to the end, just one more full day of campaigning today in South Dakota, then we return to New York for events unknown, and people are urging her to go that way, but her campaign is really going out. They are spinning. We've won the popular vote. We should be the nominee of the party, and we will see how long they cling to that argument.
Just to back up so that we are clear, the DNC Rules Committee met on Saturday to determine the fates of the delegates that were spread out after Florida and Michigan Democratic voters went to the polls. Now, they had been under a ban. They moved their primary up. So the DNC said, your delegates are not going to count. The Rules Committee got together, and they decided that each delegate would count as half at the convention, right?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, the Florida decision was unanimous, including the support of Clinton member of the committee and advisor Harold Ickes, where the sticking point came was Michigan, because Barack Obama took his name off the ballot in Michigan. The Obama people say he was playing by the rules. The Clinton people said he did that for his own strategic reasons. But as a result, he got zero votes. And the Clinton people are saying, well, if you got no votes, you should get no delegates. That's been a bedrock principle of the Democratic Party. And the Obama people say, well, she unfairly went ahead and kept her name on the Michigan ballot just so that she could have this outcome.
Well, let's
but the
talk
detail
about,
there is Obama got the uncommitteds, right? They
he
weren't
got,
actually
he
his.
He got all of the uncommitteds and then some. He got four delegates that were assigned to Clinton. This was a proposal by the Michigan Democratic Party, they said, in the interest of party unity.
Finally, let's talk about Obama. This weekend, the big headline surrounding him was the fact that he quit his church, and, of course, that was led by his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright.
Well, the combination of the events of this weekend, his, you know, more another controversy surrounding his church, which he has now quit. He's now churchless as he goes into the last 5 months of the presidential campaign. The Puerto Rican results, overwhelming, 68-32, and the aftermath of the Rules Committee, puts him in perhaps not the position he wants to be right before, it looks like, he is poised to seize the nomination.
Andrea Bernstein will be checking in with you. Enjoy your time there in South Dakota. She is our Takeaway political director. Thank you.
And I'll be blogging.
Blogging, yes. Two primaries coming up tomorrow, Montana and South Dakota. Well, if you're one of 11 million students who gets financial aid, or a parent who is responsible for the education of one of your kids, maybe a sigh of relief being breathed today. In the midst of the credit crunch, there have been a lot of worries that a credit crisis is looming for student people needing financial aid and on their way to college. Barmak Nasirian joins us. He's the director of policy analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Barmak, the federal government has launched an enormously expensive bailout program for people who are seeking student loans, anticipating that there was going to be a crisis this fall. Has it turned out that way?
Well, we don't know that it has created a problem yet. That's one of the more contentious issues here. The lenders and their allies have been beating the drums of a pending crisis. Obviously, it is too early to tell because the next cohort of borrowers were supposed to start at the end of summer.
But it is true that a number of lenders have signaled that they're getting out and have signaled to certain people that they've lent to that they're going to cut them off based on risk or whatever criteria they're using. The signs for the future are sobering if you're a student, don't you think?
Well, yes and no. Certainly a number of lenders announced that they would pull out of federal student lending. What was unknown and what we will never know because of the federal intervention is whether that would have amounted to a real crisis or whether other lenders would have stepped in anyway.
Well, let's talk about the federal program. I mean, based on what is on the books right now, the $14 billion federally backed loan program is going to rise more than double to $35 billion by the end of the summer. The federal government is going to fill in where the private sector seems to be pulling back. Do you think this is a good idea for students? And is it a good idea for U.S. taxpayers?
Probably pretty good idea for students in that it certainly ensures with absolute certainty that not a single student will confront an absence of loans. On the other hand, it's probably not very good news for taxpayers because this does amount to a bailout of the loan industry. And again, the question is whether the crisis was in fact real or whether it was manufactured by the loan industry basically to raid the Treasury.
Barmak, what do you think would be a better plan? If the goal is to get the money to the students, what do you think would work better?
Well, a more market-based approach, which is sorely lacking in our system. The student loan system is one of the very few areas that I'm aware of where a group of elected representatives basically decide in a closed room what the yield for a particular commercial activity should be.
And in fact, the Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo of New York, has called private loans the Wild West of lending because it is so unregulated. Is that what you're referring to?
Well, I'm referring certainly to that, but I'm also referring to the fact that with regard to federal loans, the much more regulated federal loan program, we have a very political process for deciding how much the lenders should make, what the rates should be, what kinds of subsidies various players get. A better system would take the taxpayer subsidy and subject the participating lenders to market discipline as opposed to political decision-making.
Regardless of the unregulated qualities, though, do you think the federal government has an interest in making sure that the largest number of students in the United States have access to the loan pool so that they can go to college?
Absolutely. The vast majority of Americans couldn't afford to go to college if it weren't for the federal financial aid programs and increasingly if it weren't for the availability of federal loans.
Barmak Nasirian is director of policy analysis at the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. If student loans are on your mind, we would love to know your story. Have you paid off your student loans or not? And there was also a fire at the Universal lot. Femi is going to have more about that in a moment. If you think that television shows archived at Universal should actually be destroyed, doesn't look like any actually were, you can give us your story of that. We actually got one response, F Troop. They want F Troop destroyed.
We should just pipe in, no one was injured in that fire.
That's right.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. One day after the beginning of hurricane season 2008, we want to consider the FEMA trailer. Both the FEMA trailer and the beginning of hurricane season reminds us of a natural, political, and humanitarian disaster called Katrina and Rita when those hurricanes ravaged the Gulf Coast nearly 3 years ago. The FEMA trailers were brought in as a symbol of the U.S. government response. Of course, 3 years later, they're a symbol of something quite different. There's actually a deadline to evacuate all Katrina victims still living in government emergency trailers by yesterday. Of course, the deadline passed without everyone being evicted. But we do have on the line Valerie Scheck-Snyder, who is someone who has been living in a FEMA trailer. You're someone who's actually received an eviction notice, correct?
That's correct.
Thanks for joining us. Describe your experience with the FEMA trailer and what is it going to mean now that you have to leave it?
Well, my FEMA trailer, I move in here in January of 2006. I returned back to New Orleans December the 31st of 2005. And I had such a problem getting a trailer. I had to get an attorney to get a trailer from FEMA. And after I received the trailer from FEMA, come to find out later that I got sick from the trailer. The trailer is formaldehyde.
And in fact, your trailer registers formaldehyde at a rate that's even that's off the scale, that's beyond the highest level that the feds say the FEMA trailers are supposed to have, right?
That's correct. My trailer was tested by CDC, 85 high with the door open, tested with the door open.
And to
85 high.
And to even live in your trailer, you have to keep the windows open and the air conditioning on full, right?
That's correct.
What's that cost?
That cost me almost $300 a month electric bill that I'm paying out of my own pocket.
Well, Valerie, hold on right there, because the reason we are acquainted with you is because of filmmaker June Cross, who is joining us here in the studio. June, you acquainted us with Valerie and the stories of other people, Katrina survivors, who have lived in these FEMA trailers for as many as 3 years now, have to get out of them. In many ways, the FEMA trailers are a symbol of everything that was promised and all that has gone wrong since Katrina. You're producing a documentary for Frontline. Thanks for joining us. Why are the FEMA trailers such a powerful symbol for you as a filmmaker?
Oh, well, they are the only replacement that the government was able to come up with for a house, and it was a pretty bad replacement. I mean, if you think about the average median cost of a house in New Orleans pre-Katrina was about $110,000. My recollection is the government spent about $75,000 to $80,000 installing each FEMA trailer, and then people like Valerie have to pay rent on the daggone trailer, and then they're going to lose the trailer. So you end up with a middle class that once owned homes. Those homes have been destroyed. They're renting trailers, which are going to be returned to the government, and they're left with nothing. It's a diminution of wealth with the middle class. They're just getting screwed. I don't know how else to put it.
And where are they supposed to go? If FEMA has set this deadline of June 1st for those folks to get out of the trailers, has there been some kind of housing that's set up for them.
No, there's no housing set up. There have been a variety of government programs. Basically, this is sort of like pioneers in the West, like every man for himself, every woman for himself. I think Valerie has been able to, she's living in a, or getting ready to move into a modular home. So, you know, some people have been able to use some of the money that was made available through other government state-run programs, notably those that know the Community Development Block Grant Program has a very controversial thing in New Orleans called the Road Home. Valerie was able to get some money through that, and a lot of anywhere up to $150,000, although the average grant has turned out to be $60,000. So you can, whatever you can, however far you can get on some combination of your own resources and whatever you were able to scrape together from various programs that the government has. You either find, make do with something else in New Orleans somewhere, or you move out. A lot of people have left.
The overwhelming truth about your story, and I want to play a clip from the film here in a moment, is that the FEMA trailers and the federal program has done almost nothing to restore the community that was lost after Katrina. Here, listen, here's the story of Sheila Hudson from your film.
Sheila Hudson had the only FEMA trailer I could find in the entire 7th Ward. She seemed like one of the few success stories in New Orleans.
You can't help but wonder. Outside of even, you know, once you put up the walls, all of this stuff can be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. But your environment, your neighborhood, what's to come of that?
Clip from June Cross's Frontline documentary that's in production right now. June, what is to become of that, the environment, the neighborhood?
Nothing. Nothing's happened. There's been the emphasis in New Orleans was that the sort of the powers that be had decided that the city had too many poor people, too many renters, and so there was an effort to try to increase home ownership, a laudable goal. The cost of it has been that a lot of the people who actually made the vitality of the community, the renters, the skilled tradesmen, haven't been able to afford to return home. So you have, they call it this jack-o'-lantern effect, where you'll have a house and then there'll be, you know, 10 empty lots and then another house, and then you go for 5 blocks and there's a house. You know, so there's, it really does feel like the Old West must have felt.
Well, it's like a bad movie set, because there are those houses, or what's left of the houses post-Katrina.
A lot of them have been knocked down, and what you're looking at is empty lots.
What do you think would help?
Oh, man. I've thought a lot about this. It would help if there was some way to figure out how to get the money to the people like Valerie Schexnader who actually need the money, as opposed to all of the subcontractors in between. That $80,000 that they spent on those FEMA trailers went to 7 levels of subcontractors. Ms. Schexnader never got it. She's still trying to figure out how to raise her home. There's a fund that should be made available for that purpose. It's caught up in red tape in Washington.
Well, June, it's an amazing story, an amazing set of symbols. June Cross, a Frontline documentary producer. Valerie, when's your move-in date to your modular home?
Well, right now I'm waiting on electric and plumbing.
So she doesn't have a move-in date yet.
I don't have a move-in date yet.
Wow. Well, good luck to you, Valerie. Valerie Schexnader is a Katrina survivor, still with no move-in date in a FEMA trailer in New Orleans.
More headlines coming your way from Femi. Okay, good morning, Femi.
Good morning. 29 minutes past the hour. The BBC reports that 8 people have been killed from a car bomb outside the Danish embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. Asim Mukhtar was sitting by a first-floor window when the blast happened.
I felt so much air pressure. It was like a huge air wave which hit me in the back of my head.
Al-Qaeda recently called for attacks on Danish targets after Danish newspapers reprinted cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Also in the news today, Senator Ted Kennedy in for surgery in a North Carolina hospital. That's at the Duke University Medical Center. Also keeping an eye on NASA. They're looking at some damage that was done to the shuttle Discovery when it shot off this weekend. It is docking at the International Space Station today. We'll bring you news of that later on in the program. And 1 month since Cyclone Nargis hit Myanmar, but not much good news from there, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, when they met for the NCAA championship several years ago, it was Magic Johnson's Michigan State team that prevailed. And Larry Bird is close to gaining revenge in that personal battle with Magic Johnson. Bird has 18 points, 11 rebounds. Magic Johnson has 16 points.
That was 1984. Anyone having any flashbacks, you think, John?
Good ones.
They are good ones.
Good ones.
And this year, it is the Celtics versus the Lakers again in the NBA Finals. The Celtics are on a mission to redeem themselves since losing their last final in 1987 to the Lakers in this legendary rivalry. It's really a throwback to past dynasties, to past final dynasties, to an age when NBA players were a little less mixed up with rape allegations and steroid use. And game one is Thursday. Lisa Salters joins us from ESPN. And Lisa, you were with us a couple of weeks ago, and you did make this prediction that it would be the Celtics versus the Lakers.
I did, and you get lucky every once in a while.
Hey.
But everyone could kind of see this coming.
You know, great minds work together. I made the same prediction.
Oh, see? Yeah, so I really just kind of got it from...
Stern made this prediction, too, actually, wishing it was...
I sort of forgot that he had. But anyhow, Lisa, what does this mean for the NBA? I don't think they could have wished for a better game. I mean, these two huge franchises going head-to-head.
Absolutely. I mean, it's huge for the NBA. It's huge for ABC. ESPN's broadcast partner, of
course. Huge for Jack Nicholson.
Which, you know is broadcasting the finals. Because, you know, as good as the competition has always been in the NBA, let's face it, teams like Detroit, San Antonio, they're not big ratings getters. But everyone will be watching Lakers-Celtics because, like you said, it's a throwback. For those of us who maybe weren't, you know, avid fans then, I mean, in 1984 I was an NBA fan, but I don't remember a whole lot about those finals, but I know the history.
I definitely do, and it's a throwback for another reason. I mean, in the mid-80s, Michael Jordan was a star ascendant, but he could never get a team that was powerful enough to make it into the postseason. You've got LeBron James sort of waiting in the wings and was
exactly
in the postseason this year, and these two teams, it's really, in a lot of ways, reminiscent of the mid-80s.
And there's so much drama behind the scenes. For folks who aren't your diehard fans, for the casual viewer, there's so much drama. It's like a soap opera. There's the Kobe Bryant thing where a year ago today, Kobe Bryant was demanding a trade. I remember being at the finals last year thinking, I can't believe he's doing this and saying these things during the finals. You know, his team is not even playing, and Kobe Bryant's getting all the attention because he was demanding to be traded. And
now Shaq's gone. Can he do it by himself?
By himself.
And then on the Celtics side, you have a franchise that's essentially rebuilt themselves. They had the worst record a year ago. Speaking of a year ago, this year they're doing so well, and Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen, they're leading the charge there.
And Paul Pierce, who's been there through... Oh, come on.
Hey, they were not great in those postseason series.
But
they were not as dominant as they were in the regular season.
But in the Detroit series, they seem to pick it back up a little bit. It's going to be
towards
a great
the end.
It's going to be a great series,
sure,
no doubt about that. But I'm interested. People keep saying, who do you want? You know, who are you picking? I don't know. I mean, I want it for Kevin Garnett. I want it for Kobe again. When you cover the league, you know, you get to know players. So it's not so much for me about franchises and what franchise I'm rooting for. I'm rooting for people, and you know their backstories, you know their, you know, their personal stories. You root for them as people.
But from a fan perspective, what's really interesting to me about these two teams is that you have this loyal base of fans that has sustained even when the players, you're talking about the players,
well, Celtics
but
fans
even
are crazy.
As the,
where are
as
they
the players
go?
Have
Celtics
changed.
Celtics fans are crazy.
Celtics fans are diehard fans.
Yeah,
Lisa, help me
DNA.
Out here.
That's
LA
that's
Lakers
DNA.
Are diehard
oh,
fans
I was gonna say,
regardless
don't
of what's
on
happening.
The Lakers fans. Yeah. I mean, you know, I lived in LA for 12 years and you know, even when the Lakers weren't doing well, people were driving around with their little Lakers pennants hanging outside of their windows, and they're ridiculous. I had never been to the Boston Garden until this season because the past few seasons, Boston hadn't been very good, so we weren't really televising a whole lot of their games. But this year I went to the garden for the first time and I got to see the fervor and I got to see what all the hype was about. Great fans, and it's going to be an outstanding series. I can't wait for it to ball in the air.
Soon enough on Thursday. Lisa Salter is the NBA courtside reporter for ESPN. You should send us your favorite Lakers-Celtics moment from the mid-80s, back in the good old days of the NBA, to MyTake at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE.
And right now, Femi Okay is joining us. And what are you following this morning, Femi?
Coming up to 22 minutes past the hour, to the hour even, Senator Ted Kennedy is having surgery to remove a cancerous brain tumor this morning in North Carolina. The iconic French fashion designer Yves Saint Laurent is dead at the age of 71. Denmark's foreign minister condemns a car bomb that has killed at least 8 people outside of the Danish embassy in Islamabad, and investigators search for the cause of a fire that ripped through Universal Studios yesterday. And Mid-Atlantic AAA has reported a growing problem. More drivers, 15% more, are running on empty and ended up stranded by the side of the road. Lon Anderson is a spokesperson for the Mid-Atlantic AAA on Hands Free, I hope. Lon, what's happening out there?
Well, I think people are not very excited about going into the gas stations to fill up. And certainly with prices, you know, 30, 50, 60 or more per tank, they are trying to delay the pain of filling up as long as possible. And as a result, we're having to provide a lot of service to folks who are running out of gas. And as you said, throughout our Mid-Atlantic territory, it's up about 15%. In some areas of our territory, we're seeing it up much higher than that. But it's a dangerous thing for motorists to do, and we urge motorists not to run their tanks to empty for two reasons. One, being stranded on the side of the road is a very dangerous thing. But two, when you run on an empty tank, your engine is sucking in all the drudge that's in the bottom of the tank, and you can end up with clogged fuel lines and some really nasty stuff in your engine that can cause damage.
Okay, Lon, that's the reason why you shouldn't stretch your gas to the very last drop. But what else can drivers do to try and make that gas go that just a little bit further?
Well, certainly, driving gently. In other words, not doing fast starts, not doing fast stops. That gives you better gas mileage. Making sure your your engine is tuned up, making sure your tires are properly inflated is very important. And also, cutting down that speed a little bit. You get much better mileage at 60 miles an hour than you do at 70. So holding the speed down can also help.
Okay, Lon Anderson, thanks very much for stopping your car to talk to us here on The Takeaway. That's Lon Anderson for the Mid-Atlantic AAA.
Just put it in neutral and go downhill. That's the best way to get
that would save
good
gas.
Mileage. Yeah,
it might get you going though, where you're trying to get.
Don't you remember like pushing the car into the gas station?
No,
a
teenager, I don't actually,
you, like, have
John.
To change to fill the tank.
But then it might increase your health insurance, though, John.
Possibly, yeah. Nothing could possibly increase.
But that's extraordinary that so many people are holding on.
I do that
before going to the gas
station.
I'm
such a Scrooge.
They're lowering their carbon footprint by walking along the side of the road with a gas can, though, right?
Anyway, Adore, you asked me why that was happening this morning, and now you find the answer.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Femi.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, and we got some good advice in there, too.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 2nd, and guess what? There were lots of movies that opened over the weekend, and perhaps
just one.
For some
one
people, there was just one.
About, yeah.
Perhaps the biggest open ever for a chick flick, and that was Sex and the City. It took in a whopping $56 million.
Is that historic?
It may be, actually. We'll see how all of the numbers confirm later today. But who says you have to see the movie the weekend it opens? Maybe you're just going to wait to hear what your friends have to say before you fork over that $10, $11, $12. We want you to help us and your fellow listeners. Tell us about a movie you just saw. Yeah,
right.
The movie you just saw. Give us a call at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tell us if it's a must-see or a must avoid. And you know,
people
what?
Did. I mean, yes. we asked for reviews last week, and we got them.
We did. A few movie buffs, they heard our call. And here's what one had to say about the big movie this weekend.
Hello, this is Kent Turner from film-forward.com. I saw Sex and the City at a packed 12:20 a.m. screening last Friday morning, and tellingly, a bridal gown designed by Vivian Westwood received the most applause. With an eye-popping parade of top-name couture, the film is hell-bent to turn anyone into a fashionista. But there's actually less sex on the big screen than on the small screen. She's fabulous at 40 and as vulnerable as ever.
Thank you, Kent, from filmforward.com. But, you know, I don't know if that was actually a rave. Here was a more, well, I don't know if it's typical, but here was a very different view of Sex in the City. It actually mirrored the New York Times, which really panned it. Here's number seven, Dylan.
Sex in the City has a pre-release adulation that's comparable to, say, The Passion of the Christ. Like the earlier movie, it's for a fervent but exclusive market. The new movie might please fans of the HBO series, but it won't convert infidels to the faith. For The Takeaway, I'm Dan Liebarger from eFilmCritic.com.
I want you to make note that both of those reviewers were men, and so it's not even necessarily a movie that was directly targeted at them, but yet and still, they went to go see the movie.
Well, they hated it. I guess I would be one of the infidels. I think I'm probably a Sex and the City infidel who's not going to be converted by this movie, but it doesn't matter. It made $56 million.
No, it doesn't matter. And here's really just an interesting tidbit, which is that according to some reports, Warner Brothers first passed on the movie. New Line Cinema decided to do it all in the Time Warner HBO family. And then New Line was folded into Warner Brothers, and executives now, of course, are busy trying to figure out how to come up with a sequel for that movie.
Right. They're all saying, it was my idea. It was my idea. I had a great idea. It was a great idea, don't you think? The other movie that came out this weekend was The Stranger, and we have a review from that. Oddly, our single woman reviewer decided to review The Stranger, not Sex in the City.
It's a thriller.
Yeah, it's a thriller. Number six, Dylan.
Prairie Miller, WBAI.org. Now, even the most random killing spree generally has a point, whether it's a bad childhood or a bad day on the part of the suspects. But the bleak and, yes, pointless slasher fare The Stranger seems to feel otherwise. A weirdly conceived presumed showcase for stars Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman, this empty-headed, sadistic McMansion home invasion thriller sits up on the screen like a tacky House of Horrors without a shred of a story in sight.
Prairie, you blurbophile, you
tacky
Prairie Miller.
Tacky House of Horrors.
Empty-headed, sadistic McMansion home invasion thriller. How many of those have you seen?
Well, we want to hear from you.
This is the biggest opening ever for an empty-headed, sadistic McMansion home invasion thriller.
If you saw a movie, let us know. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We love your reviews. Send them in.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. We were just talking, Adora, about the NBA and the Celtics versus the Lakers. Game one of the NBA Finals begins
this
on
week.
Thursday. We asked for reminiscences of old Celtics-Lakers rivalries, and we got this just in.
Hi, my name is John Roigstone. I'm calling from Worcester, Massachusetts, and I was just wanting to leave a message about my Lakers-Celtics memories. 1987, when the Celtics lost to the Lakers, I was 11 years old, and it was a heartbreaking moment. And I still remember the song that was played on the end of the game, at the end of the game, which was, I'll be back in the high life again. hopefully the Celtics are finally going to be back in the high life.
Well, they're certainly back in the finals. We'll see about the high life. That was great. That was
21
great.
Years ago. Yeah. What's it? And he responded so immediately. So, you asked the question, and he responded.
Millions of other Celtics fans out there who are ready to respond. That's the frightening, wonderful thing about it. Anyway, we're also talking about the campaign. Andrea Bernstein is blogging from the road. South Dakota primary and Montana primaries are tomorrow. But here are the sounds outside the weekend meeting that was intended, you may recall, to unify the Democratic Party. Remember that?
Florida, Michigan! Florida, Michigan! Florida, Michigan!
The answer to the question of what to do about the Michigan and Florida delegations was answered by a committee of the DNC, but the pundits on the Sunday talk shows didn't think it did much to unify the party.
We don't want to go to the convention, have a big fight at the convention, and lose the presidency.
So I was hoping for a big fight, you know, they're throwing their Special K boxes at the hotel or whatever.
Are we sure it's over? It ain't over.
You want to jump in there?
No, I don't want to jump in there.
Howard Dean doesn't want to jump in there because the Clinton campaign has suggested that they will take the fight over the Florida delegation and the Michigan delegation to the convention. But the question really is, can these two campaigns get together?
More people across the country have voted for our campaign. More people have voted for us than for any candidate in the history of presidential primaries.
And so if Hillary Clinton can win the popular vote and make that argument to the superdelegates, and apparently there are less than 200 who have yet to commit, and even if they almost all went for her, it wouldn't change the outcome. That's the argument. The summation to the jury has been made.
I wonder how many chapters they're going to be in the books that will be written about this primary, this March, the Democratic nominee. And how does the entire landscape look after the DNC ruled, after Puerto Rico went to the polls this weekend? We're turning to Professor William Boone at Clark University. Professor Boone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
It may not be an angelic ending, but the last primary votes will be made this week, tomorrow, and it looks like Barack Obama is going to be the nominee. What do you think about the DNC ruling this weekend?
Well, of course, it was a straight-up political ruling, but it was probably the only ruling they could come out with, and at least come out with a face of unity. And given the amount of tension between the Obama folk and the Clinton folk, one would like to have known what went on behind the closed doors at lunch. But certainly this is probably the closest they could come to unity and still claim to give at least Hillary Clinton some concessions.
But there certainly were signs of trouble ahead with some of that sound that we just heard of people saying, take it, Hillary, to the convention. What does she need to do now, do you think, to help unite the party?
Well, clearly, it seemed to me that the Clinton folk will probably have to tone down the rhetoric, not only from Clinton herself speaking that, but some of her supporters. And you get in a bit of that. I mean, if you move beyond Harold Ickes, remember, other folk who are close to the campaign, Rendell, for instance, make statements that appear to be more conciliatory.
You're talking about the governor of Pennsylvania.
The governor of Pennsylvania. He's making more conciliatory kinds of statements. Because I think most of these Democrats now begin to look beyond just the presidency and look in terms of holding the party together, to hold together what they have at the national level, and not to mention to bring out voters for the state elections that will be held in that same period.
Now, Professor, it does look like Obama is going to get the nomination. Now, what does he do for his part to work towards a united Democratic Party?
Well, he makes some gestures to the Clinton folk, and apparently he's done that in terms of just the idea of not objecting to the DNC's split the baby in half solution. He needs to make more gestures like that as well, I suspect. But I would think that Obama people want to be careful and see whether or not the Clinton people are going to respond in kind in terms of just what it is she can bring to help the campaign.
Is this a negotiation that's going to go down to the wire between these two campaigns, or do you think there's going to be a move almost immediately to try to merge these campaigns into some sort of symbolic Hillary plus Obama ticket, no matter how it works, who's on the top, who's on the bottom?
Well, I don't know about that latter part about in terms of Obama-Clinton ticket. That's going to be a tough one. I think no one knows the answer to that yet, but I do think there'll be some more concrete steps towards moving to sort of bring these campaigns together, but more importantly, to bring the whole primary process to an end and for the Clinton folk to at least concede that they have lost after tomorrow.
And you've said that you think that Hillary Clinton's under a lot of pressure from women's groups to stay in the race, but if it's clear that Obama is getting the nomination this week, if that does become absolutely clear, then you say she needs to be really careful or she jeopardizes her political career. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, well, it seems to me that Clinton must think not just in terms of the presidency, now what she's lost. She must think about what she's going to do once she returns to the Senate, what will her power base be inside the Democratic Party once this nomination process is over? Will she lose her any influence at all? And then there are those who talk about the governor thing, which I think is a little off. But certainly in terms of influence that inside the Democratic Party is in jeopardy if she continues to allow her people to go out and talk in terms of a disunity. Yeah, I think there's a lot at stake for her. I mean, it's just not Obama people who have to be careful, but also Clinton.
Are you saying that because you believe that there's some tolerance level that members of the Democratic leadership, beyond that point, that there will be consequences for Hillary Clinton for not abiding by what they want her to do?
Yeah, remember now that once Obama secures the nomination, his group becomes the dominant group inside the party. So there's certainly going to be some leftover, some residual feelings, some residual negative feelings about this whole campaign, no matter how much unity is displayed on the outside. So they do have to be careful. When I say they, I mean the Clinton folks do have to be careful in terms of how they position her the next time around.
Well, Professor Boone, you're there at Clark University. Clark Atlanta. We're thrilled to talk to you because we're on the air, actually, this morning at WCLK, the member station there at Clark Atlanta University.
Yes.
And it makes me want to ask you the question about what's a sort of local political issue there in, or sort of generally local political issue there in Georgia? Bob Barr got into the race last week. What does that mean for Georgia voters, particularly on the Republican side, looking at John McCain?
Right, that's a good question, because Bob Barr is now, as all of us know, is a Libertarian candidate for president, and Bob Barr is a former representative from the state of Georgia. And given that the McCain people are not exactly the darlings of a good many of these very diehard right-wing Republicans in the state, it may give them another option when it comes to the election time. And certainly that may have some impact on the Republicans and give the Democrats a little bit of sway. But that is not to say that the state will not remain red. It may tinge up a bit, but it'll still remain red. Well, that's certainly an issue here for the moment.
William Boone, professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Thank you very much.
Let's talk about the residual negative feeling for just a second. You wonder how long that really will last, because we're going to step into the general election mode very shortly, and the contrasts are going to be really being drawn between Republicans and Democrats as opposed to among Democrats.
I think also they put it aside until next January. I mean, assuming Democrats win the White House, those scores will be settled, you know, in 2009. They're not going to be settled this year. They can definitely put that away. But anyway, keep your responses coming to anything you heard on today's show. You can send us your stories at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
Andrea Bernstein will be blogging today from the campaign trail with Hillary Clinton. She's in South Dakota. She will be with her during these last hours of campaigning up to the last votes in the primary process.
And here's my favorite story. Universal Studios in Southern California reopens to the public today. Yesterday, a huge fire burned several famous props and backdrops. No one was hurt. Studio execs say they have duplicates of all the tapes that were destroyed. But we're hoping you'll send us what TV program you would like actually love to see destroyed in a fire.
Our movie mashup is on thetakeaway.org, and go behind the scenes with our producers on the FEMA trailer story and how some detectives follow a trail of grease.
Yellow
all
grease.
On thetakeaway.org. I know it's
yellow grease.
It's a different market,
yeah,
yellow grease versus other kinds of grease.
We go now to the New York market where yellow grease is trading at $70 a barrel. Yes, indeed. Also, your favorite Lakers-Celtics moment. The game one of the NBA Finals begins on Thursday. Call us or email us anytime, 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Kevin McHale, former coach. Danny Ainge, coach. Bird, former coach. Magic Johnson, real estate mogul. They've all moved on.
They've done well, too.
They have.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.